Thank you. Welcome, everybody. This part of our meeting really grew out of the consultation that the ICANN staff held with the on the base registry agreement that was held in January in Washington. And Kurt and I were talking after that about whether there'd be value in doing a similar consultation with the IPC. And that was before we had this meeting scheduled, but it's worked out fortuitously. And Kurt has, with great persistence and perseverance, made it here in the snowstorm and after many canceled flights. But we're glad to have him with us. As you can see on your agenda, the way we've organized this, which may appear a little bit arbitrary on the agenda, but let me explain why we've got it this way. The first part of this, we're going to be just quickly going through a few of the main issues that the IPC raised in its comments on the draft applicant guidebook version 3. And these are not overarching or underarching issues. These are just basically issues on which the IPC and some of its members as well have raised some comments. And between the time that we prepare this agenda and today, a document has come out that is the analysis of all the comments that were received. So we may be able to go through these pretty quickly, I hope, and at least figure out which ones have been resolved and which ones are still open, at least from our perspective. And also to get Kurt's perspective, maybe some of these are not open anymore, and it would be important to know that. The second part of this will be about the expressions of interest or pre-registration phase, and obviously the reason for that is that the ICANN board has said it is its goal to make a decision on this in Nairobi at the Nairobi meeting. And since the IPC will have, to perhaps understate it, have very little representation in Nairobi, it would be helpful just to know, is anybody that's in the room now planning to attend the Nairobi meeting?
Want to sit on a trademark panel?
Eric May, he's aware of the invitation.
Okay. Is anybody on the phone planning to attend the Nairobi meeting? Not hearing anybody. So anyway, we felt that this would be our a chance to delve a little bit into the expressions of interest phase proposal and some of the concerns that IPC and some of its members had raised, and to get the update from Kurt on where this stands. And then the last part of this this program is really dealing with these overarching issues, starting with the trademark issues that have been the subject of the IRT and of the Special Trademark Initiatives group within the GNSO Council, but then going on to a bunch of the other major issues, including a proposal from a paper that the ICANN staff just put out about the methods for amending the base registry agreement. So that's kind of the format here, and we are a small group, so I hope people will raise questions as they appear, and I will do my best to keep us more or less on schedule, but we're starting a little bit earlier than anticipated for this phase, so I think we'll be in good shape. Okay, well, turning to the comments on the guidebook, thank you, and you've got that. I listed a number of them here. Do you just want to go through these in order, or how do you want to proceed, Kurt?
Yeah, so thank you, everybody, for having me today, and thank you for struggling to get here, and thank you for attending by phone. Based on our discussion, Steve, the way I viewed the agenda was that we'd spend a brief period of time on the guidebook because we really want to the IPC's comments on the guidebook because we really want to ensure those comments were heard. So the intent is really to reiterate them here, not have an in-depth discussion, but, you know, an acknowledgement, make sure there's an understanding of what the issue is, and spend some time on expressions of interest. And so there's a few slides on that, not too many, but then a discussion of what the concerns are and how they might be addressed and where we think they might be addressed that might be inadequate. And then finally, more time on the remaining overarching issues, especially the RPMs, for the applicant guidebook and to detail these, and then the remaining issues that are listed here. So as far as time goes, I kind of see it as a little more and then more.
Okay.
So for the guidebook issues, I've really just copied down the...
Okay. Well, why don't we just briefly run through these then? Okay. On the first one, there were a number of comments about... This is about the evaluation process that all new GTLD applications will go through. And a couple of the issues that IPC has raised are, first of all, we proposed, I think ICANN had put in place some conflicts guidelines and so forth that these evaluators are supposed to follow. But our proposal was that the evaluators also should be identified to the applicants so that the applicants would, if they knew that these evaluators had some bias or had some connection with existing GLD operators or something like that, they could bring that up and challenge the evaluator, object to the evaluator. And similarly, on the criteria, the one comment that we had was that there should be a broad requirement for applicants to disclose all allegations of intellectual property infringement in connection with the registration or use of a domain name that they were aware of. So, again, have that out on the public record as part of the due diligence for applications. So those were really the two points there. Did you want to respond on that?
I do. I'm trying to tell my work associate where the call is.
Okay.
So we've had several discussions with potential evaluation firms. Fairly well-respected firms, certainly the big four accounting firms in the U.S., so KPMG, Ernst & Young, Deloitte & Touche, and other well-known firms. The Financial Times has a research arm and some other companies. And almost uniformly, they're concerned with being able to retain competent evaluators across the world if the identification of those evaluators is made known. So if you think about the structure of it, there'd be, you know, they'd have a core team and then a team under them, so who would be responsible essentially for the consistency of results and the publication results and transparency concerns, and they would be known, but their reach out to evaluators, which generally sit in every region of the world, indicated that there'd be difficulty retaining competent evaluators if their identity is known. So the issue for discussion then is what if that holds to be true, and we're balancing, putting the best, we're trying to put the best process in place. The question is, are there conflict protections or mechanisms that can be put into place in lieu of making the identity of the specific evaluators known, so that each applicant can do their so each applicant can essentially do their own conflict check. So I know that I've sat in the interviews with all the potential evaluation firms over the last month. We interviewed each of them for at least 2 hours each. And, a half hour of that 2 hours is routinely taken up with how are you going to manage conflicts. And, some of them have an excellent plan, and some of them are kind of cavalier about it. It's a very important evaluation criteria for ICANN to we're spending too much time on the very first one. But spending time, it's very important for ICANN to manage the conflicts very carefully based on past experience. So I don't know if there's any comments, but I think that's the discussion going forward. Is there a way to not divulge the identity of the individual evaluator, but have competent conflict management procedures in place so that everybody feels comfortable? So that's the balance of what's going on.
Any comments on that? In terms of the criteria and the disclosure of all allegations of IP infringement in connection with domain names, do you know offhand if that's something that?
So is that?
It's in the criteria in the diligence part.
For the
applicant.
Yeah, for the applicant. So we recently upgraded the guidebook and put background checks in there, and one of the criteria was prior UDRP involvement. And that's raised some criticism because, you know, people who have been on UDRP cases don't want to or be, you know, be excluded from. So there's been criticism that it's too far the other way. And clearly, you know, just being involved in an UDRP case does not automatically disqualify one. It's just one factor to balance it. So I don't know if...
There's a difference, Kurt, between being involved in a UDRP case and then over a period of 12 years having been serially involved in UDRP cases where you're losing 98%.
Exactly. Yeah.
At some point, subjectivity has to come into this process.
Right.
It cannot be a completely objective criterion. And there's always going to be someone who falls on the wrong side of that line that's going to complain. But the reality is, if we don't put into the structure some sort of check and balance to get these things up front, we're all going to be spending both ICANN, the potential applicant or registry, and the intellectual property community a lot of money trying to rectify it on the back end.
Yeah, so you're preaching to the choir, you know, as far as me representing the guidebook. I think my question is, do you think what's in the guidebook is adequate as far as calling that out? Or
The concern that we have is that UDRP is not so much of an issue, because that's public record anyway, although obviously it could be obscured. But we're concerned about other types of intellectual property infringement. If the operators of the Pirate Bay, who were criminally convicted of copyright infringement on a massive scale in Sweden, were to apply for a new TLD, we'd like to know about it. And we'd like to know if they have a connection with that. And so really a broader statement of allegations of intellectual property infringement in connection with the use of a domain name, I think, are very important. I imagine the Pirate Bay has never been part of a UDRP case, but obviously I think it's quite relevant if they were to apply for a new TLD. So we would want a broader
relation. That it needs to be a criterion that's far broader than just trademark infringement.
Right.
I think you've left out content infringement. Some of that is more nefarious and more difficult to track down than actually the trademark infringement.
What is content infringement?
Creative content infringement.
Well,
I would say
copyright infringement. Okay.
Thanks, Steve. Kurt. And
if you put people on the phone, not only loudly, but announce your name. And the people on the phone, if you cannot hear the question, would you say something so that then the moderator could repeat the question for you?
Thank you, Jay Scott. Mike Palage. Kurt, building on the comments of Jay Scott regarding a pattern of abuse, not just sort of UDRP, I do believe there are situations where you can look at domain name portfolios of potential applicants where, in fact, if people have, you know, registered domain names involving, if you will, famous trademarks or celebrities or something like that, I think that also potentially goes to part of the, if you will, background check. So I think it's not just, as Jay Scott said, UDRPs, because sometimes you can register a lot of infringing names and that trademark owner may not get around to, in fact, bringing an action, but that could be one of the other criterias in looking at, you know, the qualifications of that potential applicant.
Okay. Did everybody hear the question? Or did you have a response on that?
So I'm on board with that. I'm just trying to, you know, to the extent you can offer a specific suggestion later on how to redline the guidebook and augment it. Because, you know, we definitely captured the spirit of that based on comment from the IPC and others in the third version of the guidebook, but realized that, you know, augmentation of detail would be good for, you know, for both sides.
Okay, let's move on to the next topic, which is the community objection procedure and also how it interfaces with the legal rights objection. And I think, these issues are ones that we've discussed with Kurt before, but I think the two issues that the IPC raised are that that a community that an objector that satisfies all the standing requirements should benefit from some type of presumption of detriment if they're objecting to an application that purports to represent their community. That's number one. And number two is that If an applicant, this is the complete defense, which always you have to kind of, it's a little bit like, you know, tying your tie in the mirror. If the applicant would be eligible to have brought an objection against somebody else, if they would have had standing to bring an objection against somebody else, then they win the objection if somebody else brings.
Right.
I mean, I think what this really boils down to is the idea that if a community, an organization representing a community, doesn't want somebody else to get the to have a community TLD, you know, directed at them, their only option really is to get in the pool and apply for one. They can't sit on the sidelines and object. So these are the two concerns that we had there, and I guess I'd like Kurt's sense of whether these issues in your mind are now fully baked, or are they still open for further discussion?
So I thought they were fully baked based on our response to your last set of comments. Certainly, in order to assert, in order to assert the complete defense, the applicant now has to be a community-based TLD. In the past, it didn't. So we made that change based on IPC comments, and that defense, if you're able to assert that defense, you're able to demonstrate that you have a legitimate right as a community group to that name. So it's conceivable, easily conceivable, that two different entities would have a right is the wrong word, but that they could use that community-based label as their TLD. And so if you have a legitimate, I'm losing the word right again, but if you have a legitimate right to that community-based label because you're in a community that identifies with that label, then it seems that you should be able to apply for and use it and not be stopped because someone else has a similar right to that label. So that's kind of how it seems to me. And then what was the first part of the question about?
Presumption of detriment. It's similar. It's a similar question, really. If a group meets all the other criteria, why would they have to prove detriment? They've shown they represent a community, and somebody else that they object to is applying for that.
Yeah, so that seems like a fairly low bar to me, if you can. So the detriment is still in there, because if there's no detriment, then there's kind of no harm. So we've always viewed that detriment required as a fairly low bar. If you can show all the other stuff, then it seems natural that detriment follows. So that's what our thinking was in getting to where we are right now. And you know, so I just want to reiterate that we did make some significant changes to the guidebook based on the IPC IPC comments, and in particular, a meeting we had in Mexico City to discuss that.
I think that's right. There have been some significant changes, but I guess the question at this point is, you know, I guess we're going to expect to see the same provisions in Guidebook Version 4, which I guess is being released in June. And should we? If we still object to them, should we put time and effort into objecting, or is this over? Is this discussion over, and we should be advising our clients?
It's over.
We should just be advising our clients, this is how it is, and if you are a community group and you don't think somebody else should get it, you have to get in there and apply for it yourself. Even if you don't want it, you have to apply for it yourself.
Well, if you don't want it,
but you don't want this other guy to have it.
For example, if the other guy's Pirate Bay.
Yeah, let's take that example.
So, yeah, but that see, then you're saying Pirate Bay, and I'm not familiar with that. Sorry. But if it's Pirate Bay, they have to be able to demonstrate that they're a bona fide representative of that community with the support of that community, and that's their TLD. I mean, they have to say they are a community TLD and they represent that community and have the support of that community, and so they could be blocked from it. But you know, the American Red Cross versus the International Red Cross, you know, the American Red Cross might have a bona fide right to the TLD Red Cross. And if the International Red Cross doesn't want it,
I think that's a little bit different, because in the when you're talking about the legal rights objection procedure, you don't have
right.
to get in the pool.
That's right.
If you can prove
right.
the legal rights objection,
right.
even if somebody else might have some claim to it, you're going to win and they're going to be knocked out.
Right.
But it's not the same in the community area. If they have some claim to it, in other words, if they would have standing to bring an objection, if you brought it, in the mirror, then you can't stay out of it. So the two are treated quite differently. That's one of the concerns.
There's also the fact that some organizations, like your Red Cross example, they may be thinking about applying later. They may think we'll sit out the first round.
And basically, they wouldn't have that option in the community setting, because somebody else could come in and get the name, and they wouldn't have any ability to.
Right. So that's the balancing, right? That's the hard balancing. Do you set up a process where, a community-based organization interested in getting a TLD and plopping their, $185,000 on the table, plus, all the larger investment having to do with infrastructure and setting up a TLD, should they be able to be stopped by another community representative having a right to that label, but deciding not to pursue it. So, what's the better result, to have somebody make that investment and be stopped by a bystander who decides just to play the stopping game, or, tell people, if you have a legitimate interest in that name and you do represent that community, then you can apply for it and get it. So that's what we sit around people talking about.
So that's how the balance has been struck up till now, in the latter way. To say,
right.
yes, if you think this would really be a disaster if the Pirate Bay got it, let's assume that they could meet the standard, then you better jump in there and compete, go through the comparative evaluation procedure, and if neither of you win that, dig into your pockets, because we'll auction it off. I think that's kind of the way it's been resolved now. And I guess the question to think about, and we'll get to this after the EOI when we talk about, how resolved are the questions that are resolved, is whether this one is, in your view, you've kind of been through this discussion, and maybe, you feel like you're pretty much there.
Pretty close. Yeah.
Pretty close. Other comments on this point? C, the morality and public order objection. I think the IPC's concern there was, first, there's this idea of a quick look. When someone files a morality and public order objection, there would be some quick look procedure to try to get rid of frivolous claims, and we think that's important, and wanted to know how that would work. And the second one is, there will be an independent objector who has the right to challenge highly objectionable GTLD strains, and our concern was to make sure that the independent objector has the sole discretion to decide whether something's highly objectionable. In other words, if he objected, no one could come in and say, well, that may be objectionable. It's not highly objectionable, so you don't have standing to bring that claim. So responses on the quick look and the independent.
Yeah, so the quick look only gets a couple sentences in the guidebook, so that procedure needs to be fleshed out with specificity. And to the extent that there's ideas here about detail or aspects of that procedure, any input would be welcome. I think the independent objector being truly independent might need to be fleshed out a little bit more, given the concern you just said about not being overridden by other entities. And so I read the IPC comments about ensuring the independence of the objector. So I think that needs to be emphasized.
Okay.
Any other comments or questions
on this point? Okay, moving on to the fourth one, the auction procedures. Now, IPC, of course, is not a fan of the auction procedure anyway, but we can get into that. But we also had some fairly specific comments about the procedures that were proposed. One of them really had to do with it was a little unclear to us if the winning bidder didn't, you know, was in default or didn't come through with the money, what did the second place bidder have a right to get that, or wasn't clear whether they could expect to be offered it, or whether it was kind of be up to ICANN to decide whether they could get an offer?
I thought that was really clear. Isn't it clear?
Well, one says will receive an offer, and the other one says the runner-up applicant has no automatic right if the first place winner does not execute a contract. So that was, we thought it was somewhat contradictory, and I guess that was one concern. The other was about the very short rounds, which I think it's kind of in hours rather than days.
So I can answer that one maybe. So that's based on spectrum auctions. So the company that designed this auction process has run several auction processes like that before, and the idea is that the parties to the auction, so there's similarities and differences, but the similarities are the parties to the auction, you know, there's a long period leading up to the auction, so the rules and how the auction is going to take place and the timing of it, there's considerable time to prepare for that, so that that on the appointed day the parties get together and conduct the auction in a period of time that's right there. The difference is with auctions like this that have been decided in the past is instead of the parties actually being prohibited from talking to one another, and in this case the parties are encouraged to collaborate and try to arrive at a more economic solution. So it's thought that, you know, rational parties will settle the issue before getting to auction, because that's the most economical way to go. So if there's, reading it from the outside and saying, oh my gosh, this whole thing happens in a few hours, that can be daunting. I think that given the appropriate time to prepare and the right education and the party going and sitting into the room and say, okay, today's auction day, I'm ready to go, I think that work, but there's nothing, I certainly don't have any, or ICANN doesn't have any big interest in the timing of how the auction's conducted.
Jay Scott and then Mike.
I think the biggest question mark is what happens if the winner defaults. And it's little questions like this that in my particular instance that keep creeping up in the DAG that are very frustrating when trying to give someone an idea of expectation. There are question marks that you fall off a cliff on so many issues, and that is very frustrating because it is really important what happens if we don't come through. It's important for the entire community to know, does that mean there's going to be another auction, or does that mean that we just step down to the next person? So I would plead with you or ask or request or whatever I need to do to take down these points and take them back to staff and seriously deliver us some clarification on issues like this.
You know, I am, and I think the guidebook's pretty darn good. And
I'm just saying that there are roadblocks when you are reading it from the outside that I know when I draft documents, many times the questions seem all answered in my head because I've spent so much time with it. And it's not a criticism, it's just a request for more clarification on questions.
I hope you have a wonderful summer, baby. Stay warm, stay dry.
It says, once declared in default, any winning bidder is subject to immediate forfeiture. After a winning bidder is declared in default, the remaining bidders will receive an offer to have their applications accepted one at a time in descending order of their exit bids.
Okay. I think there was a contradiction between that and another provision there. And in your comment, in your analysis, you said, we agree and we'll redraft section 4.4 to be in line with 4.3.
Yeah. I remember that. So I think you've kind of responded to that, Mike.
Thanks. Mike Blage, in order to prevent potential defaults, since that brings a certain amount of uncertainty into the process, would ICANN consider potentially looking at sort of the pre-qualification of the bidders? And let me give you a specific proposal here for your consideration. Under question 50 in the DAG right now, a successful applicant is going to have to post a financial instrument, either a letter of credit or a cash escrow deposit, representing 3 years of operational expenses. Now, based upon the benchmarking document that KPMG put out last week by ICANN, even for a small registry under $250,000, KPMG has cited a $2 million annual cost for running a small registry under $250,000 names. Therefore, that translates into a $6 million financial instrument that a potential applicant is going to have to post. Would it not make sense for ICANN to require that financial instrument be in place before the auction starts to prevent people? You know, if we're really looking for people that have the wherewithal to come in and operate a registry, protect registrants, that seems like a prudent step as a pre-auction mechanism to keep out tire kickers or people who default.
Okay, Mike's question was about pre-qualification of bidders by requiring them to have the financial instrument to guarantee readers of operation.
Yeah, so I'm looking for a pre-qualification requirement. It's a really good idea. I think the bond is going to be less than $6 million.
If KPMG has done an analysis, and they, why would staff, on what basis would staff differentiate from the analysis that KPMG has done?
I'm talking with registries and discussing some actual costs, realizing that there'll be some smaller registry startups.
But the KPMG survey was based upon interviews with both CCs and CCLA registries.
Right. So anyway, we're in active discussion with registries to try to ascertain the right number there. But the balancing I think needs to take place is, you don't have your TLD yet, so. You've sat in a lot of ICANN meetings where, $185,000 application fee is a bar, and a lot of the requirements in the guidebook are bars to smaller registries, regional registries starting up. And so, I think that a pre-qualification of auction participants is a really good idea. I think that making it millions of dollars in the event there might be an auction a priori is will raise criticism that ICANN's excluding the people less well funded people.
But wouldn't
ICANN
subject itself to more criticism by allowing people into the route that don't have the financial wherewithal to protect the registrants that they're going to be taking money from?
Well, I think the guidebook's really carefully written to ensure that without ICANN taking on the role of a venture capitalist, that applicants have the technical and financial wherewithal to execute their business plans. So I think that's pretty well done. And no matter what it says is going to be criticized by one party or another. But it seeks to do that balancing by saying, what's your business plan? How much money is it going to take for you to operate this registry? And then it says, so how are you going to get that money? And then it's for the evaluators to say, be an expert enough to say, that's the right size registry and that's a good technical plan. How much is that going to take to run? And then look at the financial plan and say, that seems reasonable.
Well, going back to the benchmarking document that KPMG has produced, at the top of that document, they said that this will be used by the evaluators in evaluating their business plan. So in this document, I believe the capitalization for the registry's interview will be between $5 and $8 million. So I guess what concerns me, is I see a lot of people running around saying, for a couple of $100,000, we can get you into the route. Now, based upon the evidence or survey that ICANN's experts has produced, that seems to be totally inappropriate by a magnitude of several fold. So this is one of the reasons why I think I'm concerned with staff deviating from those benchmark criteria.
Well, it wouldn't when we create the criteria for the bond, We wouldn't deviate. The bond is based on the applicant's business plan and the evaluator's determination, the expert evaluator's determination that that business plan is rational and, will result in a registry that protects the registrant.
So,
Scott.
I guess what I would say in general, and what I hear Mike drilling down to in the point, and something that I would say is constructive criticism that I want to present to ICANN, is the fact that message control has been sort of sloppy in this whole process. Bottom up is one thing, and that's a wonderful way to develop. But message control to what goes out to those that don't sit in these meetings, 1,200 people around the world, and know this stuff, is there's not been a very good PR effort to sort of control the message, and so there's a lot of rumor and innuendo going around. And I think there needs to be a very concerted PR effort to make sure that the general public, the CEOs and people who are picking up the Wall Street Journal or something, understand sort of the parameters of what this is really going to take. Because there are a lot of people who believe that for $150,000, that's what they're going to do. They don't even take into effect that doesn't even get you in the door as far as I can, and then there's ancillary expenses on top of that with regards to whatever your personal expenses are for flushing out your business plan, working with your lawyers, making sure you have the necessary insurance. So I would just say that somewhere somebody needs to start taking control of this message, because we've seen this before in other launches, at least with regards to what domain name on the second level you could buy. There's a lot of vaporware sold. You know, go ahead and pre-register with me or pre-work with me because I can get you in. And that's going on right now. Personally, I think that's what's driving the EOI process, is because a lot of these people have sold vaporware, and they're now getting people wanting their chips filled out with some sort of progress, and we don't have progress. So, again, I would just say we need better messaging from ICANN about what the realities of this system are.
Okay, I think Ken had his hand up, and then I think we need to wrap up this item and move on to the next one.
Just a couple quick questions about the idea of what would be your assessment in terms of making sure that someone's not going to fall. And also the idea of an auction is going to the highest bidder, right?
Right.
So just trying to protect the smaller entrepreneur or someone at that point makes less sense, I guess, because that's the way you're setting it up.
Yeah. So I've been trying to spin this up the whole time I'm sitting here. I think a deposit's required on the part of the auction participants. That around the expected value of the auction. So, that's why we engage somebody who's expert in this, because they know how to do that. So I think that's one way about it. And, yeah, so your second question is the whole discussion. You know, if you don't conduct the community priority exam that is intended to benefit those smaller community-based PLDs against the larger entities,
you've already got it all. Each one has a right to
execute that. Right, that's right. Neither of them do. Then what's the next step? And you know, just by that community priority, you know, developing that. When you read that, you know, I think that's pretty good work. But it's really hard. And we can talk about it next if you want. But
perfect segue.
it's really hard. And then to conduct some sort of beauty contest after that, there's the idea about, you know, efficient use of resources, too, and you want the TLD to be successful and also be obtained by the entity that most highly values it. So, that's another thing. You sit around the table and talk for hours all day and try to develop something that protects the small guy against the big, but at some point, you know, you have to let it go to the resource, you know.
I'm definitely down to talk.
Okay, so let's move on to the community priority evaluation, which is our next point. This has gone through some changes as well, partly in response to comments from IPC and IPC members. But what keeps and so there's more detail about what the criteria are. But one problem that we see is that the threshold you have to meet keeps changing. First, it was 14 points out of 16. Then it went down to 13 points out of 16. We thought that was a good step because we were concerned that this whole thing would just be a funnel into an auction. Even if there's only one community priority applicant, if it can't meet this threshold, and if there's some non-community people with one in the same string or a string that's in the same contention set, they get funneled into the auction. They went down to 13, and now it's back up to 14. And I also see, now that I've seen your analysis, that maybe you're thinking about, you know, maybe that isn't baked yet. But this was one of our major concerns here, because at 14, we think very few community-based applications will survive this process, and therefore they'll end up in the auction. And there were also a couple other points that were raised about whether there should be an appeal from this community priority decision. So, and how much does the decision have to be documented? So maybe we could turn to Kurt's responses on those.
Yep. Hey, Jay Scott, what's the passcode
for
the call?
IPCAM.
Okay. People are having trouble getting in.
They're having trouble getting in. Are people on the phone now?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Anybody on the phone?
Yeah.
Yep.
Are they muted?
No, we're not muted.
I'm getting questions. There are questions coming into his OE.
Oh, good.
Okay, well, good. Well, we can.
The people are hearing them. I mean,
okay.
Can you get people in the audience to repeat the question? It's hard to hear.
Okay. We'll try to do a better job of that.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, the balancing and community priority, of course, is to ensure the, you know, true community DLBs are given a preference, which can be a very valuable preference. If you demonstrate that preference, you get the TLB in cases of contention. So one way to look at community priority is to say, if that's your label, you know, you should get it, and you should be protected against it. So, you know, if it's not, so I hate to use examples. So dot Navajo, you know, that's my label, and, you know, I should have it, nobody else should get it. And so so when there's this strong, strong nexus, this uniqueness between the label and your community, you should get it. So, you know, if you're the Boy Scouts of America, you know, Scouts is kind of your label, but it's other people's labels, and, you know, but Boy Scouts or something more specific, then you should get extra chits, because if somebody else gets that label, then you know, so we want, if it's your label, we want that entity to get it, and if it's a bunch of people's labels, you know, you should get less of, you should have less of a right, boy, that's the wrong way to put it, but less of an ability to get it using this mechanism. And the ability to exclude others who might use that label too. So that's why the scoring is high, and that's the sort of balancing to go on to make sure if it's your label, you get it, but also try to ensure that there's not some gaming going on, that people use the community priority mechanism to take what's really a generic name and keep it from others. So, and that's, you know, I don't know, we're talking about decimals, and we sit in rooms and do scenarios all day, and so to the extent, so how can we be helpful? To the extent that you run through scenarios and say, here's why 14 doesn't work, you know, for what would be a bona fide community-based applicant that should get it, or, you know, some demonstration of back and forth. So we realize that's where the rub is, and to close an interesting discussion. And you know, just another aside, but I'm taking up too much time. We've interviewed, you know, service providers to offer evaluation services, and we gave them, you know, a few examples to run through, and they cluster around the same score, but it's all around a close score. Yeah.
Okay,
Kurt. Perhaps you can give us one of those examples to let us understand what generics might qualify for a community or not.
Can you repeat?
Mike Pelage is asking if Kirk can give us an example that has been discussed with the provider.
Yeah, so one example is Dot Bank. You know, so I don't know what the scenario was, and it was a very short scenario, scant on details, but here's Dot Bank. It's wanted by the American Bankers Association. There's there's a Arabic Bankers Association that complains that they shouldn't get it. Dodd-Bank is supported by the ABA and also the OECD, members of the OECD. So, you know, go ahead and score it.
And what did they score? Did it pass or not pass?
It went through. You got to make assumptions. But, you know, it got a 14 by some, a 12 by others, and a 13 by others, depending on the assumptions they made.
So is it fair to say that unlike what we were talking about with community objection, that this is still in
play? Yeah, I think
so. Play?
This is still in play.
Okay. I mean, because in the COA comments, we give the scenario of how difficult it would be for a community group to, you know, if they lost one out of 5 points that we list about whether they're of longstanding and considerable size and whether their name means something else in any other language. You know, I think it's very easy to lose a point or two, and considering that if they're challenged earlier on in the process, they're going to probably lose a point in your analysis and two in our analysis. I just think a 14 is going to be very, very hard to meet for some bona fide groups. So that's our concern, and it sounds as though this is still somewhat in play.
Yeah.
Now, what about the idea of an appeal or what type of documentation of the decision would there be? I mean, do you anticipate that the evaluator would say, you got 13 points, and that's enough or not enough, and here's the points we gave you?
Yes or no? So that's something we're talking about with the potential evaluators right now and what they're recommending as far as report detail. And what's been discussed so far is not a long report. It's a short report. So, certainly, I think that so a specific writing as to what the report should look like. But right now it's, you know, here's your score, here's essentially the thought behind each score. Boy, right now an appeal isn't contemplated, maybe for the same reasons why we're against appeals in the URS.
My one comment to you would be, if you're going to get an appeal one way or the other,
right,
you're either going to have it built in or you're going to get it. So, you know, you want to put in some sort of mediation or arbitration situation where you all sort of have a little bit more control over it. But I'm just saying the appeal is built in whether you build it in or not, and you need to recognize that reality. And I would suggest to you that if you want to control the environment in which it gets a de novo review, you better build in some sort of system for that, or you're going to have it done by someone that doesn't understand the parameters or the system and doesn't control, and you're likely to get some answers that you don't like.
Did everyone on the phone hear Jay Scott's comment? I'm going to take that as a yes, unless you're otherwise on the list. I would just also add to that, you know, if we think about this, if you're going to have the same system in subsequent rounds, it would be good to have some type of guidance and precedent so that people would know in the future, okay, here's how you make 14 or 13,
right,
here's how you don't. And perhaps more in this area than in some of the others. So, Mike Palage had his hand up, and then we'll try to move on.
Mike Palage, just building on Jay Scott's example there, Kurt, this is all about predictability. In light of, you know, ICM's recent independent review, which was a multi-year process, that's one of the potential mechanisms that we're dealing with here. We're just talking about delay. And if ICANN really wants to sit there and provide predictability for businesses to speed this thing along, I think addressing it through the DAG is the way to do it before people use other appeal mechanisms, both under ICANN's bylaws or through the court system.
Yeah, so I guess I don't know. I guess the answer to that is if it does go to court eventually, what gives ICANN the best foundation, right? If we have this system and an appeal, or we have a pre-published system, we say here's the rules, sign up, you know, say you'll follow the rules. So I think, you know, J. Scott, it's just an excellent point, and we'll turn it over to our council and figure out the risk averse.
Yeah, okay. That's for you all to decide.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else on community priority evaluations? If not, let's move along to registry pass-through of who is obligations, which is sort of an ungainly way to say why doesn't the registry agreement or else perhaps the evaluation criteria take the approach that's used, for example, in the .Asia registry agreement, in which the registry says we will require our registrars to take certain steps to ensure who is accuracy, and if they don't do that, they won't be our registrars. We're pleased that Thick Who Is seems to now be part of the program, and that there will be publicly accessible Who Is with the full range of data for all these registries. But there's always the problem of Who Is accuracy, which
what's the .dot Asia? I don't know what the .dot Asia agreement says.
Okay, we've sent you the I don't have it in front of me, but it basically says there are requirements that the .dot Asia says in its registry agreement we will require our registrars to have a plan to ensure Who Is accuracy, and it's not very detailed, but I think it has some. It's basically a pass through.
No, I understand the pass through
registry, and we've raised the IPC has raised this a number of times. It could either come in the registry agreement, in which case it would be an obligation, and presumably if the registry didn't pass these things through, they could be in trouble under the registry agreement, or it could be an evaluation criteria. For example, you could get extra points in the evaluation if you said, not only will we provide a thick who is, but we will take these steps to make sure that our registrars are vetting this information or doing something to try to ensure who is accuracy. I'm speaking at a very high level of generality here. And I think the response that ICANN gave is, well, you know, thick who is the status quo. We're not trying to go beyond that. But, in fact, the status quo in if you look at .Asia, and there may be one or two others, is a little bit beyond this. So, and we don't think that the status quo ought to be a ceiling. So that's the question on registry pass-through, and I will turn it over to Kurt for his reaction.
So I think the better place for it would be in the agreement, not in the evaluation criteria, which is just a bunch of promises anyway, right?
So
that's what we'd look at next.
Oh, now what have I done?
Can you just the mouse?
Oh, cancel. I could screw up your computer, huh?
There you go.
Yeah.
Okay.
Jake Scott's computer is set up backwards, and the left button is the right button.
The reason is because we have an ergo department, and they come in and they give you an evaluation, and they make me a left-handed mouser.
As a left-handed person, I wouldn't even know how to do that.
They
set
you up
right anyway. All right. There's a question in the back, Sheldon.
Hi, Sheldon. Hi. Maybe I misunderstood, but it seems to me fundamental requirement that needs to be seriously addressed. I'm not sure I understand what the particular requirement is for the registries if that doesn't pass through to the registrars. The registrars are the ones that the consumers and the public and mark owners have to interface with. If they don't have the requirement to ensure who is accuracy, then what good is it?
Okay, Sheldon is just stressing that, Sheldon Klein was stressing this is an important point, and the value of Thick Who Is would be very much undermined unless there's this pass through on in the registry agreement on who is accuracy. I'm just repeating the comment.
Yeah, so I understand your comment, right? No matter how thick it is, if it ain't right, it's not really useful.
It doesn't matter how thick it is if the people who really pass out the domain names aren't required to require the Thick Who Is.
Right, so I think the issue is going to be, you know, how much does this represent a policy change or not, and the sensitivity all around that. And
but I think Steve gave you your panacea, and that is to say, we're not going to require it. We're just going to give you extra points. I can tell you from the ether that is milling about that I hear on the blog, they're going to do whatever it takes to get the point. And so if you make it something that gives you an extra point, everyone's going to sign up. Every requirement that we put out when we've had discussions, those that are most interested in getting their TLDs, and I will use Doc Berlin as an example because they have been one of the most prolific and aggressive about getting through the system. They came to us and said, we'll do everything you want voluntarily.
They even said they would come wash our car.
They offered me a BMW. But I'm just saying, those that really want it or want to be responsible or trying to demonstrate to the community to push themselves above the whole ploy, that they're willing to do it. I think Nick has advised clients, they're willing to do whatever it takes to make them the best practice, best applicant to get recognized and pushed through the system.
Okay, let me just add in terms of the status quo and the policy questions. I think there are at least two registry agreements that already have this. .Asia is one, and .Mobi is the other. And then, I don't know, there might be more. So it's not unprecedented. Let's put it that way. I agree there are a lot of registry agreements that don't have this, but I think it is a best practice, and for the reasons Sheldon raised and others, I would urge you to consider it. And I guess I'd welcome your advice on how we can best move this forward because, again, we've raised this a number of times.
So I think to give a sense of urgency to it, I just want to kind of finish. We'll look at the language in the .Asia registrar agreement, which I guess is where it is.
No, but I think it's actually in Appendix S of the .Asia agreement. And it's in Appendix S of the .Mobi agreement. But you're right. I mean, there may be something provisional.
It's there Appendix S.
Yeah, okay.
So, and see if we can, and then respond to the IPC in some way and say, here's our analysis of this in the next few weeks.
Terrific. Okay, thank you. Any other comments on this point? Our last point in this section of our consultation is on limitation on the ability to redelegate a .brand TLD. And this is really kind of at the end of the process in the registry agreement. It basically says if for whatever reason the agreement is terminated, that ICANN has the authority to redelegate. In response to our concerns about this, how this would apply in a .brand setting, it was added that ICANN has to consult with the TLD operator. The question is, or the one that's being terminated or that is terminating, but the question is that enough? If you successfully go through the process and get your .brand top-level domain, and for whatever reason, let's say you decide, this really isn't working, we thought it would be a great idea, but it's not such a great idea, we'd like to shut it down. All the registrants are our employees or or we've made some accommodation for whatever registrants there are, but we just don't want there to be a .brand TLD. We've decided, if we're Sony, we just don't want .Sony. But now we see that ICANN has the authority to redelegate .Sony to the Sony distributors or people that want to talk about Sony or anything else. So has this gone far enough with the consultation requirement, which I think is a positive, but shouldn't there be, if you're going to accept .brand top-level domain applications, shouldn't there be some separate provision on it?
So we want to focus on protection of registrants, right? And so if there's a TLD, a really easy example for me is .post, right? .post by cease operations, then its member states don't want its data transferred to, So then what would be appropriate for registrants? One scenario, the most straightforward one, is when you apply for the TLD, you go, if we go under, if we stop operations, we're stopping, and you registrants, you're going to lose your name. And then, so when you're a registrant, you get a big notice that says, if we stop operations, there's not going to be a transfer. So that's like the simplest way to do it. But you know, one concern there would be then we'd get all the applications would say that because, you know, who cares if I go under? I don't care. Or would there be some other criteria? And then it gets really sticky right away. If all our registrants work for Dot Brand or are employees of Dot Brand, or if all our registrants meet some criteria, so we demonstrate there's no harm to registrants by closing down, they're really just using our service, or if there's some mechanism where the registrants, you know, agree or something like that. So I would rather create a mechanism where there are some additional conditions, but you know, I'm not so sure that can be worked out. And for me, if I'm the operator of this process, I'm really happy with the, you know, quick and easy. You know, we gave you notice, registrant. You're on notice that this TLD could shut down and won't be transferred.
Okay, I guess
so So I think ICANN's open to understanding that there are several different types of TLD, other than including GRID, that might shut down and not want to transfer the data to a different successor registry. So I'm just looking for input on what we think the best way to accomplish that is. Jake Scott has a question.
I guess one of the points that I see that I've not seen answered with regard to the stop rate scenario and falls in the Step Act is I don't think ICANN has either articulated to the community or thought through, and I don't know which it is, the license issue. I mean, if I am .yahoo, right, that is my trademark, a $6.8 billion asset. And I am not, by making an application to ICANN, if I'm .yahoo, in any way going to sign anything that either expressly or impliedly devalues or states that you somehow have control over Yahoo. So there needs to be, the only thing I can think of is there's some license involved, but that issue hasn't been thought through very well, and that falls into the delegation issue. And what I'm also concerned about for ICANN and for companies thinking about this is bankruptcy. If I go bankrupt at Yahoo, and ICANN says, well, we're going to redelegate, I can guarantee you, having done bankruptcies for the last 17 years, that a bankruptcy trustee is going to say, oh, no, you're not Yahoo, going to give .yahoo to affiliates or to VeriSign, because that's the most valuable asset, and someone is going to have to buy that right from us.
We already have a case of, like that with a registrar, right, where the bankruptcy court has said we're going to make the assignment. You know, ICANN not. But is the way out of that to have something in the registry agreement that says, you know, that the CLD just won't be delegated? Because I can think of trademarks that are more generic names that could be used easily, especially if a company has a bankrupt.
Maybe you need to put out a memorandum that is not in the contract, but give some sort of thought process behind scenarios so that the community is sort of informed. Because I can tell you, when it goes to the board of directors to make a decision, that I just articulated about giving that dot means we're somehow giving or admitting it's not a trademark or it's somehow you have control is a big issue.
Yeah.
So you've got a lot of law firms working for you. They need to put some thought into this, and I would suggest some sort of supporting memorandum behind it that sort of gives just sort of an explanation of what your thinking is behind this, because there are people desperately wanting to know the answer to that question.
Okay, other comments on this point? Mr. Pelage.
Kurt, you brought the suggestion here to address these concerns. One of the problems we have right now is that in the proposed baseline registry agreement, ICANN is looking to get $25,000 annually from the registry operator. Perhaps to address the concern of a trademark owner wanting to take a name dark, we could look at the existing baseline agreement of TOMA for Dot Museum. Dot Museum, which currently has under 5,000 names, only pays ICANN $500. also .coop and .arrow. They their contracts, which have under 5,000, pay. They have under 50,000 names. They pay $5,000 a year. So perhaps, as I said, for trademark owners, they want to pay $500, which is what ICANN is collecting from its smallest ICANN GTLD sponsored registry. That can seem to be something that would be a problem.
Mike is just to repeat for those on the phone, Mike's comment is that this could perhaps this could be addressed by the fees that are paid by .brand TLDs and put them more in line with those of the very small registry.
You mean a maintenance fee if the TLD ceases operation? Just like a
keep it dark fee.
Okay, so in other words, that would be paid after it.
Right.
Okay.
So as I said, if you're not actively using it, and again, we're using, we're basing that fee on a contract that ICANN currently has with the DTLD registry right now at $500 a year. Unfortunately, and this hasn't changed, is why .coop and .arrow pay $5,000 for 50,000 names. ICANN wants to increase that fivefold.
Okay. At this point, we've come to a breaking point, and I would like to take 5-10 minutes for those on the phone so that people can get coffee here in the room. People on the phone have the luxury of stepping away to go to the restroom. Those of us in the room do not have the same luxury. So if we could come back at 10:40 to call, that would be great. Give Kurt a chance to catch his breath. And so it's 10:30, 10:40, we'll be back online again. Thank you all so much.
Jay Scott.
To sign in, for anybody who hasn't signed in, the room next door over here has caught another refreshment, and both restrooms on this corridor and around the corridor.
Thank you.
Steve, Jay Scott.
Somebody told me last time I need to do J.Scott.
Scott.
Sorry. I just send it out with all the huge decay to people. Okay, that's the, what you're going to do is
hold on.
Log out of the room, restart your machine.
Do I have to restart my machine? Can I just go down here to bed?
Give it a shot.
How did that come up when I did that? Connecting to Fred. Okay, I'm on.
Okay, now try to connect to you.
Okay. 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 Okay
when I get their obvious document.
And that's only because there are non-IPC members that I feel responsible for during that time.
Right there. So now you're going to log on. And you've got other sort of internet applications going besides stuff on your machine, besides like, it's pretty low bandwidth.
I don't think I have anything up. I need to turn my messenger off.
Jay Scott.
I'm trying to find my Yahoo back somewhere, and I don't
Jay Scott.
We have one before. Yes.
There it is.
The dedication. Sean.
Hello.
Do the network that I keep getting on my Wi-Fi?
Yes, the
Frederick
Wi-Fi. Yeah,
interesting. I mean, just, that's like four full bars, but the Baker is only like two bars.
Yeah, we're trying to use that to get people online right now. But you can get a VPN connection for him to get onto the Adobe Connect.
Is there a Wi-Fi that I can tap into, you know?
There is. It doesn't work for VPN. And there's basically what you do is you go to VH guest.
Yeah. Oh, do you have the key?
Yeah, the key is right here.
Yeah. I'm only getting two bars on VH guest.
Very low.
I'll try it.
So then you have to go to a browser. You know, what has to be your password. Just use username and a password. And they're both cool. I will check it in. I've just logged into Adobe, and I want to know if you can see. We've fixed that technical capability. I want to know if you can see the screen.
There's a very lovely presentation there.
Adobe Room as well.
Yeah.
So if someone would state whether they can see the Adobe Connect screen.
Yes. Your screen is being broadcast to all participants, is what it says. Jay Scott.
That's because your screen is, I mean, I assume they're seeing whatever I
see. I see.
I mean, I don't know. Usually it does show in there, but.
Oh, my gosh.
Jay Scott, can you hear us? Jay Scott.
Yes, can you
hear us?
No, we can't hear you, Mark. But he says, yes, he can see the screen now.
Excellent.
So I'm going to log it up.
So that works.
And for everyone who wants to know, That was brought to you on behalf of Mark Monitor and their brilliant fulfillment. So thank you, Fred, very much.
You're welcome. Good luck.
So you're live now to the participants. Thank you.
It is Jesus'
statement. That's what Mark said. Right. I can't hear them for some reason. They have them generally muted. I don't know.
Yes. It was. Okay.
If they can see the questions, and we can then ask the questions on behalf. I'm going to step to the rest and get a cup of coffee.
Perfect.
Chief, that officially appointed a scribe?
I think Nick is
the
scribe, I believe, yeah.
All right. We all are forward.
Everybody please take
real or virtual seats. Okay, first of all, let me just say to those on the phone, for some reason, although you have been seeking recognition, as I understand it, for some reason we're not hearing you. But the good news is that the Adobe Connect room is now up and running. I don't know if anyone has at hand the link that people are supposed to follow to get to the Adobe Connect room.
It's in the cover email with the agenda.
It's in the email that was sent out by Jay Scott with the agenda.
And it's highlighted in yellow.
And it is highlighted in yellow. And that has a chat function. And our scribe, Nick Wood, is monitoring the chat, I think. And so when there are questions coming from the field, he will interrupt or at appropriate point. So we apologize. I'm not sure, and maybe we can check on this after the next break as to why the phone is not, whether everyone seems to be muted, which I don't know.
Well, after lunch, we have a different number, too, so that may help.
Okay. All right. Okay, so we're back, and we're now talking about the expressions of interest.
Why can't the registration? Well, I think the Adobe Connect from out.
There you go. Oh, he's wanting to get on to it.
To chat.
My computer.
Oh.
Okay, so
we're on the expressions of interest issue, and as I mentioned, this is one that the board said they wanted. The goal is to act on it in Nairobi. I think IPC has commented at least twice on this, and so a number of IPC members with a number of concerns. And I guess I probably the best thing to do would be just to, I guess Kurt has some slides on this, and let me just turn it over to him to explain where we are, what response there is to some of the concerns that have been raised, and what he expects will happen in Nairobi.
So I think that there's been two public comment sessions on the expression of interest round and analysis of that, and you know my thinking is that that ICANN and the people that are considering this are really in lockstep with most of the comment, and I think that if there is a difference or maybe there isn't, it's about timing. In other words, a lot of comments don't go forward with the EOI until several things are settled, and I think that's exactly where ICANN is. So the question is, can you do development work on the EOI and plan for its launch while you resolve some remaining issues? The understanding that if those issues aren't resolved by that time, that the EOI wouldn't go ahead. So I think I have like three slides, so I think the best idea is to run through them and then take questions. In discussions, in the public comment discussions with the NTIA and others, that's great, thank you. It's been pointed out that we should identify how the EOI serves the public interest. So, so if everybody on the phone can read the slide, I don't need to read it. Anybody can monitor in the chat room and tell me if people can. But anyway, we think the EOI serves the public interest by facilitating the launch of the program in a secure, stable, and well-organized way. So what are the benefits? The benefits are to fix the number of applications we're going to get in the first round and get some other information, too, identify instances of possible string contention and potential objection. That would help operational readiness and also help identify any unanticipated issues. So it provides some flexibility, too. If we look at the list of proposed strings and think, oh, my God, we didn't think of that, you know, it provides some flexibility for ICANN, to take a step back and say we've got something else to resolve. And it may inform or may not inform the economic benefit discussion and that sort of economic analysis that has to occur. And at the end, you know, probably will hasten the launch of new GTLDs because it'll answer a lot of, question marks we all have about uncertainty going forward. So it gives us a chance to look at the potential strings and, have a stop there before actually launching the round. So you know, especially this first round, there's so much uncertainty as to what we'll see. It'll provide that certainty. So what are the elements of the proposed model? I think they're well known that the way the model's proposed is sort of a mandatory requirement. If you want to participate in the first round, you participate in the EOI. That there's a fee that's non-negligible that's required, and it's been set at an amount that's equal to the non-refundable part of the $185,000 fee. That fee is essentially non-refundable unless the round is not launched. And if the round is not launched, there might be some nominal amount kept to cover costs. That participant and string information will be made public. So if you look at the guidebook, I think we've asked that questions 1 through 14 be answered in that some 50-some-odd questions in the whole guidebook. A prerequisite, and I'm going to talk about prerequisites next, but that a fully executed communications plan would be undertaken prior to the launch of the EOI. So the communications plan would be exactly the same communications plan as required before new GCLVs are launched to ensure that, you know, nobody in some region raises their hand at the end of it and says, gee, I didn't realize this was not going on. Now, that's sure to happen, but, you know, that's certainly the objective of a very substantial communications plan. And that there's not going to be any evaluating that occurs. So this information will become in, strings will be published, applicants would be published, and then the remaining work to launch the TLD round will occur. And in the meantime, you know, it might be sort of awkward because there'll be a lot of discussion about the proposed strings, but, you know, there's not going to be objections that can be taken in at this time. There's not going to be a start to the evaluation. So this is really a shortened edition of the prerequisites to the EOI, but certain issues need to be settled before the EOI is launched. That, you know, what are the trademark protection mechanisms going to be? You know, the three-character issue and the vertical integration issue is really who can apply and what can they apply for. So certainly that needs to be settled. And certain other guidebook, you know, the goal of guidebook version 4 is to be so close to the final version that there's not a substantial change, because that's the whole version of the public comment and iteration process, that we launch this full communications plan and that we're operationally ready to discuss the process. So I think that's the last slide.
Okay. This is Jay Scott. First, I want to say, as president of the ITC, that we are of two minds about the EOI. There are those who are definitely opposed, and there are those that are not opposed. So you need to take that into account. But as a person who's sort of walking the line on this issue myself personally, I can see the efficacy of sort of finding out what the lay of the land is, so you know operationally what you need to do to staff and to be ready to put these things into the root. What I don't understand is why you've designed a model that is ripe for gaming, that is only going to increase anxiety when there's a thing, and is mandatory to apply. I can see you taking in private information. I can see you publishing the strings to say we've received 50 or 100 or 1,000, and here are the ones. You don't need to disclose who the applicants are. You don't need to do these things. You might identify the categories that they said they were going to be, and all of that to inform the process. But the process, as it defines me, seems to be a secondary or maybe a pre-market for gaming. And I think that is a fundamental flaw with the way this is set up.
So why do you think it's right for gaming?
That you can transfer an EOI applicant, can transfer that, so now we can get into a situation where I'm in, you come to the table late, and now I can say, well, I'm willing to sell you my EOI slot for $26 million. Or I think all of that is problematic. I think that making it mandatory so you shut out someone who doesn't want to make the $55,000 commitment at this point because, hell, you've been saying for 2 years you were going to enter things into root and you're still not there. And in the economy we find ourselves in today, people aren't making choices like this 2 years out. They're making things 6 months out. And so I think that if you want to give preferential treatment to an EOI, okay, or give a point to them because they are pre-cleared some of the hurdles, or charge an additional fee to someone who doesn't do EOI, that makes sense to me. But locking people out, just makes it, you're gaming. And then when you lock them out and you allow transfer, it's the same thing as first come, first serve on the second level. It's just a different model for the same problems we have on the second level.
So so everything's a balance.
Yeah, absolutely.
So the other side of that is when we were talking about EOI, we said really there's three choices. We make it mandatory, we make it voluntary, or we don't do it. And in looking at the cost and the benefit, we said, well, we think if we're going to do it, mandatory is best. If not, we probably shouldn't do it because we already have, whatever market information we have based on, people standing up and saying, I'm applying for a PLD. And frankly, the voluntary one was, a distant third of those three choices that a voluntary round would cost even more than a mandatory round because you're not accomplishing part of the TLD processes, so you have to go back and do that. And, the value of the information is, could be scant because you don't know the numbers.
Then I think my criticism would be, why are you doing it at all? Because it seems to me then you're only building a system that answers the VCs who are pissed off, who have gone around and told everybody for $100,000 you can get in. Got all these people signed up, and now they're saying, well, we don't have any answers. You told us this would happen 14, 18 months ago, so why do you care? You have the information you need. Why are we even having this entire discussion? It seems to me if you have the technical information, the market information you need, you're just throwing a bone.
Oh, but I don't think we have that. I don't think we have the technical and market information we need. I think that there's, first of all, let me start with when the idea of the EOI was presented, I was, slightly horrified that I don't know if we want to do this. And after examining it for a period of time and talking about it a lot, I'm personally now to a point where I see significant benefit over detriment. But we don't know how many applications there's going to be. We don't know what potential issues there are. There's going to be a lot of inefficiency in gearing up for the GTLD process because we don't know the types of strings we're going to see. And so a lot of risk can be taken for ICANN and for the community can be taken out of the process by having, this sort of UI where then there can be a check and a stop to operational readiness plans to determine if there are unanticipated issues. And so I don't think we have accurate information now. And I think the information we see would be very valuable. I'll just to explain much more, I'll talk a minute about transfers and whether that would occur or not, whether there's an EOI could occur later in the process. And the idea, and whether ICANN could successfully regulate transfers, you can talk to a bunch of people that say transfers might work to the benefit of registrants in the longer run because resources or flow to their area best utility or something like that. So there's arguments along those lines too. I'm not sure transfers, are necessarily bad, and there's others that can argue much more convincingly than I. So I think that. So I've sat at a table and argued both sides of all your issues. Vicki?
Thank you. Thank you for the information that you want. But stop the foreclosure.
So is that Bertrand?
Yeah. Vicki Schechler asked the French government's proposal that Bertrand de La Chapelle put forward that would use the EOI to lock in strings, but not the applicants, if you will.
So wouldn't, well, actually, Bertrand has a couple different proposals.
Okay. Can I just make a point on this? Because as I read your analysis of this, I'm not sure that you had the same understanding of Bertrand's proposal than I did. Because as I understand it, Bertrand's proposal is people would come forward and submit items 1 through 14 or whatever the heck it is, and that would define the universe of potential strings that could be applied. But and those people and those applicants would also be in the pool.
Yeah.
But other people could then come in and say, well, actually, if Jay Scott is going to apply for .widget, I think I'd like to apply for .widget too. And so you might have a second round.
Right.
People say, yes, I want to be in on it too. And then I think the point is that you have all the information you hope to get from the EOI model. You would have, except about string contentions, you would have that like a month later or whenever the second round happened. I think that's his dual call, I think that's what that refers to.
And I also have a question. You said something about transfers and regulators. Did I miss it? Have you taken out the provision that says for string contention, one of the resolutions is not?
Wait. Can we back up first and just talk about the French proposal and get to that?
All right. So Bertrand, are you on the phone? Good. No, not good. So he's also made another proposal. So maybe that's for
I can't keep up with
yeah.
it.
Yeah. So isn't it a concern with that one that the TLD would go to the person with the most money, that some guy has a great idea and says, here's my proposal, and then somebody goes, oh, man, that is a great idea. I want that one, and let me elbow. So I'm really concerned that sort of scenario would serve to the go to the disservice of the originator of ideas and the small player. So I'm not so sure that works. So
I'll say that from another people.
Okay. So I suppose
just one thing, just in language, this is a Berners proposal, isn't it? It's not a French proposal.
It is a French government proposal.
Oh, it is a French government.
Yes, according to Bertrand, it is. I mean, I don't. I'm taking that at face value. Okay, but now let's go to let's go back to Jay Scott's. Well, I guess anything further on? I think the French proposal. I hear what you're saying, and of course, because you are locked in on auctions as the way to establish this, you basically you're already in that position. Whenever people have the same idea, independently. They're going to end up in an auction.
Right.
And
but they
even when there's a community involved, if it doesn't meet the 14-point test. So I think that's a flaw in the entire program from my perspective, but I agree with you. It doesn't really address that. I just think it would at least partly deal with Jay Scott's concern. You wouldn't have to lock in. It wouldn't be the mandatory aspect to it because others could come in and apply. But let's maybe we should get back to Jay Scott's other point about transfer, and you had raised a point about what's in the draft applicant guidebook.
I guess a couple of things I want to raise. My point earlier about why even do the EOI was based on your point that when you said it's voluntary, it would be very valuable because we feel like we already have adequate information. So
I don't say, if I said the word adequate, then
that's what I heard. So. Secondly, you just said it would be difficult with transfers in EOI because we don't want to regulate the market on transfers. But in the DAG that I've read, you say that a string contention between two applicants cannot be resolved by forming a joint venture or anything like that. So it seems to me that seems to be duplicitous. I mean, if on one hand you can't, and on the other, it just seems to me that you're talking out of both sides of your mouth. Either you can do it,
that's
or you
better.
Can't do it.
So the intent of the guidebook is that if there's two applicants and they combine to resolve contention, that is a new entity that has to be reevaluated. Say there's two big companies that are interested in the same in the same string, and they form a joint venture. That joint venture might be substantially underfunded compared to the two large entities. So what the guidebook is really saying is that a reevaluation is necessary if there's material change to one of the applicants.
Okay, well, in the EOI process, if you're not going to control any kind of transfer, how are you going to ensure that second comer that buys that place in line, because they have to put in an application and they'll get their evaluation at that point?
Right. So that newer applicant has to be the applicant for the new GTLD process and pass the financial and technical criteria in order to get the, that evaluation hasn't occurred yet.
But once they fail, then because it's mandatory, then that string is out of the first round. So what you've done is you're not doing enough due diligence, which I think has been a problem in this entire process, is that I buy in, I'm weak second comer, right? I buy dot sport, place in line, I make an application, the evaluators say, these people aren't going to cut it. They don't have the financial wherewithal. Because it was mandatory, now dot sport is out.
Until the second round.
Okay, I think we had a question from the chat room. Is that what
you're... Yeah, thank you. It's a very simple question. Will the slides be available? Can you make them available to
the slides that were...
Yeah. I did these last night, so I might scrub them and then I'll send them.
Okay. Picking up on this point, I think when I first saw the EOI plan, I thought I saw something in there about how having this pre-registration is a way to get a jump on the due diligence research that would be needed. But apparently that's no longer the case because these would be freely transferable. So it wouldn't make any sense to do due diligence on me if I could turn around and sell my slot to
Jim. Yeah, so there will be some due diligence. So at least... As an American company, we can do business with certain entities and not others. So even to accept an EOI response and a fee, we have to do some due diligence into the background of the applicant.
Okay, I understand that. But in terms of the due diligence that's required for the application process, all these things we were talking about, like disclosing all of your felony convictions and everything like that.
Yeah.
That also has to be done anyway at the application phase, right?
Right. So.
Because I might.
So it's exactly the same thing as applying for a new TLD. I think ICANN will take advantage of the opportunity to do some due diligence, and then if there's a change to the application somehow, that has to be redone, just like. In the new GTLD process, if you make an application and then you change your application materially, aspects of it need to be evaluated.
Let me, I had another question, but I think Mike Pillage had one.
Thank you. Kurt, with regards to the communication plan, does ICANN have one in place right now?
Yeah, so we've published two versions of it. And
the question was about the communications plan,
yeah.
For those who may
Yeah, know. So two, you know, there's a version of the communications plan, there's public comment. And there's a revised version of the communication.
So you feel that staff feels confident with what they have right now?
Yeah, I mean, it's being fleshed out with more detail with specifics on dates and releases. And, it's still being fleshed out. We're going to write articles about this. We're going to write papers about that.
And, again, the only reason I ask is last night I – posted on its web correspondence Minds and Machines that was basically advocating ICANN to launch communication plan at Nairobi, and considering staff tend to follow the Minds and Machines recommendation.
Do we?
I would tend to see a lot of similarity, just my personal opinion. But again, just helps to know what's potentially happening in Nairobi. One other
question. Wait, is that a question you wanted? Were you asking the question of whether it would be launched at Nairobi?
Yeah, so I think that if the board were to, say, launch the EOI at Nairobi, we would start the communications plan after that and then conduct, at least a 4-month communication plan.
I have to tell you that that's problematic to do something that large and that significant at a meeting where so many people with interests in the community are not going to be able to attend and have their voices heard is extremely problematic.
Let me see if there are there any other questions coming in from the our chat room? Okay. David has a question in the back.
I've understood that the formal communication period would start
David Taylor asks whether the the communications campaign will start only after DAG 4.
Yeah, so I think the plan that's been put forward so far would be to start the communications plan after the board does launch the AOI. And so the work, no, so I guess the short answer is no. So the communications plan part of it and the final work on applicant guidebook 4 would occur in parallel.
Okay. Nick had a question. Nick Wood.
Once we're talking about communications, then a number of potential private brand applicants that I've spoken to just don't understand the term expression of interest. This is the only way of being included. Is it not possible to call it stage one of the application?
I think the title of it is pre-registration process.
Can I ask one question about the communications plan, and then I want to move on to a couple of these other bullets. But I see in the document that the staff put out last week, I guess, there's something called the TLD acceptance campaign that would start in August 2010. What is that? What is that?
That is that. Think about a few years ago, if TLD wasn't three letters, it didn't always work. So we had an acceptance campaign to get info, then, travel and museum. You know, we started a public information campaign. So it's more about that. And so it's a reinvention of that process where longer TLDs, software developers and application writers will write accepts all, all TLDs.
Okay. I understand that. Let me just, are there other questions? I'd like to go on to something else on this slide, unless there are other questions about the communications. On the preceding bullet, you list three things that have to be resolved in order before the EOI would launch, I think is what this is saying. And two of the vertical integration and three character issue, those have to do directly with who can apply and what can they apply for. I see you've added trademark RPMs, and I suppose on behalf of the IPC, we're glad to see that on there. But why aren't there are a lot of other issues, such as the security requirements, such as the economic analysis, and I recall in Seoul Rod Beckstrom saying maybe we can find a way to really incorporate this into the evaluation process and make sure that the kinds of TLDs we're approving will be adding value. I'm paraphrasing here, but I think that he said something like that. Why just those three, or is it just those three?
Yes, that have to be resolved? So I think that there's prerequisites to the EOI, and then the EOI is useful in a way because it will serve to inform the resolution of other issues. Mm-hmm. So certainly if look at that. So
okay.
Paul is raising his hand, but in a chance we need to acknowledge people can hear him and ask a question.
Right. So among those, in addition to this, I think there's been a lot of changes to the guidebook to address the potential for malicious conduct, but there's work ongoing there. There's the high security TLD, centralized zone file access. We're trying to get the closure on those issues, too. So I think those things would be settled prior to the EOI.
So in other words, this is an illustrative list. This isn't an exhaustive list.
It's not exhaustive.
And if those things aren't settled, the EOI shouldn't launch.
That's right. But there's other issues that the EOI might inform. So, for example, root scaling. I think that's pretty close to closure, and I have some interesting stuff to show us when we get to us on root scaling, but that could nail for the technical community, oh, there's only going to be 300 new TLDs in the next 3 years. I feel better about life for a while. So that issue may be resolved. The economic study's ongoing. We're going to talk about that in a little while later, too. This will tell us a lot about demand for top-level domains. It might not answer questions about second-level domains to the extent that we want, but it could be informative. So I think, you know, root scaling and economic study that, you know, don't have to be resolved as a prerequisite for the EOI, and, in fact, the EOI may help resolution of those. Malicious conduct and trademark issues, you know, I think those need to be resolved as a prerequisite to the EOI.
Okay, so I think we had a question from
Paul McGrady.
I'm afraid I can't see it yet. If anyone else can see it, please shout out. I'll get it back in a minute.
Okay. All right, but if I understand you, I mean, this will, I think, will be of interest to the GAC and others ICANN is saying it is not necessary to complete the economic study issue before launching, starting gun and having phase one of the application process. I agree with Nick, that's probably a more realistic description. But the economic study is not on that list, but there might be some additional things on that list. Brent?
I have a small question if you'd like.
Okay.
Is there a chance that vertical integration will be resolved by Nairobi? If not, is staff saying that EOI will not be decided?
Okay, right. Did everybody hear for those on the phone who didn't hear the question, it's will vertical integration be resolved by Nairobi, and if not, misstating the question?
No, I was just going to say I can quickly answer that, given that I'm on the chartering committee for the GNSO that is putting together the vertical integration working group. So I would assume that charter has yet to even be approved by the GNSO. That policy work has yet to be informed. That working group has not been formed. So definitely it will not be resolved before Nairobi.
So there's two tracks, right? There's a public discussion applicant guidebook track for vertical integration. That will not be resolved by Nairobi, but will be resolved. You know, there'll be something. You know, guidebook 4 won't be published without some resolution of that. And then there's also the policy discussion that may finish within 120 days, as they've claimed, or might, you know, as Jay Scott just said, the charter's not written yet, so it may take longer than that. So I think the answer to that, Paul, is that that won't be resolved by Nairobi, looking to resolve it by Brussels. And then Victoria Carrington has a question.
It's actually Jonathan.
Yes. Okay, let's go to Claudio, and then we'll come back to Victoria.
Claudio again. Kurt, my question was, just in terms of timing, why is the board trying to get a better understanding that if there are these still overarching issues that need to be resolved, why is the board voting to continue the DOI before it is resolved after?
Okay, the question was, why is the board setting the goal of voting on EOI before the overarching issues are resolved?
I think to you know, not being in the board's head, you know, I think because of the benefits that the EOI promises, and that is by providing the additional information when the process is finally launched to provide those benefits, certainty as to the number of applications before we launch, you know, providing some insight as to what types of objections there might be or what kind of strings are applied for. So we can garner that information now, so long as we adequately communicate and ensure that people aren't excluded from the process because there's a lack of information dissemination. So I guess, the balancing is
the balancing is to not do an EOI, resolve the remaining issues, and just launch the TLS
well,
process.
I guess part of your confusion is the same confusion I have. Your slide says here, prerequisites to the EOI, and then you list resolution required for. And so if that's a prerequisite to even do the EOI, why is the board going to vote on something? Because, again, it's one of those false start messaging issues sending out to people who don't follow this. You've told us, well, we're not going to launch it until we do these things, but we're going to vote on it and approve it. It's just, it seems to be the dog chasing its own tail. I mean, it seems to me you shouldn't even vote on it until you find out that you've resolved these issues. I think that's where we're coming from.
Maybe it's that the board was a little vague. It said our goal is to do this in Nairobi. It may be that they will say, okay, we agree we're going to have an EOI and it's going to work this way and it will be launched after these things happen.
Okay.
So they're not saying we'll launch it now.
Okay.
And then maybe we'll have some dates for it.
So in other words, it would be a conceptual thing to say the concept of it will go forward provided we do A, B, and C.
That's right, and start these communication activities and start these things, resolve these things first.
Mike?
Is Victoria?
Okay.
Yeah, I'm back now, sir.
Mike, go ahead.
Okay, so, Kurt, with regard to vertical integration, obviously staff has done a lot of work or has focused most of this attention on vertical integration with regard to discussion in the registrar and registry communities. Unfortunately, ICANN staff has not yet addressed the issue of vertical integration with regard to a brand TLD. Right now, the DAG says that all ICANN accredited registries must use ICANN accredited registrars. Therefore, a brand would be forced to incur the additional burden of becoming an ICANN accredited registrar to contract with itself. Does it not make sense, and even ICANN's own economists have acknowledged that it is appropriate for registries to go direct, would it not be appropriate in the scenario of a dot brand to allow a brand to deal with itself without having to deal with ICANN credit cards?
So categories of TLDs are all about there are about two things. One is the ability of a TLD to differentiate itself as to type or what market it addresses or, add value to the marketplace. So those sorts of categorizations are exactly what new TLDs are about. Categories of TLDs, and so I'm speaking very frankly, categories of TLDs to get some sort of special accommodation are more problematic, and there's many proposals for types of TLDs that should get some sort of special accommodation. Community TLDs might not have to pay full ICANN fees. Geographic TLDs might not have to sign an agreement with ICANN because they're like CCTLDs. Socioeconomic TLDs should not have to pay any fees. Nonprofit TLDs, might get some other different form of accommodation. And so far there's seven or eight different proposals for TLDs, each with different accommodations. So there's, seven times eight, 56 different debates to be had about how to hammer out those additional accommodations before establishing a process. Wait. And there's the contractual compliance enforcement environment, which to me sets up a nightmare for ICANN as far as being able to succeed. So let's just talk about I get all excited when I talk about it. Let's just talk about brand TLDs, which I'm conceptually for, and I personally think it is the path to trademarks being able to better protect themselves. And I think, new TLDs are, the path out of the Wild West of everything.com and trying to address that. But, what is a brand TLD? Is it just the employees of a company? Is it the employees and the contractors, or the employees and the customers? And how do you draw a compliance line? So you're saying, let's have a special accommodation, and these guys don't have to use ICANN accredited registrars. So now there are a bunch of ICANN accredited registrars watching on the sidelines for these brand TLDs to tick into some gray area of operation and saying this is a compliance mechanism where I think that, so here's what I really think. I think, so now we're in an ICANN meeting, right, and we're in Nairobi, and people are saying, gosh, I don't have $185,000, and I'm from a developing country. That's another category of TLD, by the way. Can I get some sort of special accommodation? And the other part of the room is saying brand owners should get, should avoid the, $4,000 a year registrar accreditation fee. And but by the way, if they have the registrar accreditation fee, they get to register names at the second level, at most for 18 cents a name, and they can use the architecture of the DNS and third level names to like get rid of that whole fee. So I think that the current structure where there's few categories, community based TLDs about it, and that was a policy requirement. I think brand owners can operate within that without creating a really difficult environment. So right now brands aren't in the guidebook. And
we need to move to the next thing. We can take this offline, Mike. I don't mean to cut you off. But we have slotted 60 minutes, which is going to be compressed to about 30
right.
for this next presentation. So I'm going to take the gavel here and move us forward just because we need to keep on. And for those on the phone, since we are running a little behind, I think we're going to take the lunch break around 12:10 rather than 12 hard stop to allow Steve more time because he's really put together a very robust agenda for this particular part of the program. We want to make sure that we don't cheat it too much. So I appreciate everyone. Again, if you are in Adobe and you're attending online, for some reason we cannot hear you. If you have a question, please post it to the chat and Nick will repeat it for the room. Thanks.
Thank you, Jay Scott. Okay, we'll move on then to some of these other issues that we said we would discuss here. So we've listed here really five issues. It is the four traditional overarching issues, I guess we can call them that, and then there's a fifth one about registry agreement issues. And in each case, by the way, there are, since this agenda was drawn up, there have been some documents issued by ICANN. But I would like to, I'll just turn it over to Kurt at this point to go through his slides and his presentation on this about where these different issues stand, and then we will start with the trademark.
Yeah, so can I watch this?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, let's start with the trademark issues, which are obviously a concern.
So this is a group in the know. So, the IRT was formed. There was excellent work product. There was public consultations in Sydney, New York, Seoul. The SDI was formed. And ICANN took in the SDI work. Modified it very slightly and published that as a set of trademark protection mechanisms in the guidebook and around the guidebook. And so the trademark mechanisms are supposed to protect the RPM. Yes, take a breath. The RPMs are intended to address pre-launch and post-launch of a registry. So the IP clearinghouse is supposed to address the pre-launch phase of a registry and the URS and post-delegation process, the quiz, are meant to address ongoing TLD. So provide protections in both areas. So I'm going to talk about the trademark clearinghouse, the URS, and post-delegation disputes about rights. I hope everybody can see this, but what is the IP or trademark clearinghouse? It's a database that performs two functions, validates, puts marks into the database, and then provides data to registries to support pre-launch and pre-launch IP claims or sunrise process. So trademark holders only have to register once. And it'll be operated through a third-party agreement with ICANN. So we would contract with one or two entities. One might be the people that let the trademarks in and validate the trademarks, and the other would be the other entity would be to provide the information, operate the database, and provide the information to the registries. So what the key aspects of the key aspects of the clearinghouse is that a registry either has to operate a sunrise or IP claim service. What's in the clearinghouse? So the FBI made a distinction between what gets in the clearinghouse and then what the registries have to use. So what's in the clearinghouse are all quote validated marks and all nationally registered marks. What marks must the registries use? So what's in the guidebook or what's in the document that slips into the guidebook is slightly different from the FBI, and it's registered marks with substantive review, which means nationally registered marks that undergo substantive review and also court-validated marks, and also registered marks without substantive review that can be validated in some way, so undergo a validation to get into the trademark. So is that clear? I just want to stop.
So how would the trademark clearinghouse validate? First of all, decide which marks have been registered without substantive review. Would that be based on a country by country? Country-by-country allocation beforehand, and then once they decided something had been issued without substantive review, how would they go about validating?
Yeah, so...
I think that is not answered, and I don't know if they've done... They don't address it in the paper that I've seen about how would you... Who makes the determination, and I think there's been a lot of comment I've heard is... What does substantive review mean? Because you use the term, but then the term has never been defined as what it means, and that has caused a lot of ambiguity, and that's going to be your big debate, first of all, is what does that mean and what are we talking about?
Yeah, so certainly it would be the role of the clearinghouse. Like, we're all going to hire some entity together to do this, and... Again, I'm sitting up here in front of you pretending to know stuff, but I'm not an expert in this area. But, in the GNSO discussions, there seemed to be the ability to draw a line between countries that perform substantive reviews and those that don't. And, the STI view was to not require registries to use trademarks that from countries that don't have the substantive review. The approach here is envisioned to be the same approach when we were considering common law marks, like what sort of validation do you put a common law mark through that they demonstrate usage and whatever those things are.
I understood from reading the document, looking at some of the transcripts from the FBI, what you seem to be saying is that if it is from a jurisdiction that doesn't do whatever substantive review is going to mean, that then that, as a registry, I can choose that has to be a validated mark, even if I have. So what you're saying is, and if it's .blog, this is what I call the .blog exception to begin with, because that's where this is all about, then .blog would have to show that they are actually using that mark. They don't just have a registration.
Right.
They have a business behind the registration.
Right.
That's the kind of validation they're looking for.
And they get into the clearinghouse as a validated mark, and then the registries are required to use that in their IP claims or sunrise.
Yeah.
Okay, now the IPC had proposed that instead of discriminating between different countries as far as whether they had substantive review, this could be resolved by things like deadlines, so that if you'd have to have your mark registered by January 1, 2009 or whatever date was chosen to sort of avoid the gaming here. Why was that not followed by the staff? Did the staff consider that as an option to this, where someone is going to have to say to a country that's a member of the GAC,
yeah,
gee, your trademark registration system doesn't have substantive review.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, and so I don't.
Why was this alternative? Was this alternative considered?
Yeah. So describe the alternative.
The alternative was to say any country, any national mark would be included, but there would be safeguards such as saying you had to have gotten the mark prior to some date prior
so,
to
so old.
Yeah.
Well, I think.
And I think there were some other suggestions.
I think that's still built in, that a registry can choose to do that within its Sunrise process, because they've all done that. It's usually a year before their application is published or something.
Yeah.
But I think Steve's question is, that seems to have solved the problem with regards to this. But as I understood the discussions, and I don't mean to call anybody out in particular, but it's my understanding that this concern was brought up by Jeff Newman, who is aware that certain registrars over the last 4 or 5 years have gone out and gobbled up a lot of generic internet-related words from these registries that don't do a genericism descriptiveness analysis nor require any sort of use. Okay, and not to pick on a particular country, but Belgium is where one of these is owned.
Yeah.
And they're concerned that they're going to muck up the system by asserting rights in .blog and saying, you can't now apply for this because I have the rights in it. And that's where all this comes up. And that's where it's most driven now.
Yeah, but this is on the registry. The Sunrises of Tails or H EU, they've all covered this question. You can't.
Can I try and, Michael, I just to affirm what Jay Scott has said, I think a lot of clarification to my campaign is whether the substantive review is intended to capture examination of absolute versus relative grounds.
Right.
And additionally, WIPO cannot support, and this echoes the view made by IGC, that it's not right for IGC to take a position that prejudices national trademark schemes such as Belgium or the majority of trademark national offices in Europe, for example. So I think that's something that really needs to be reevaluated.
Now, as I understand the staff's proposal, and I may be misunderstanding it, they said that the registry has a choice. What they gave them is a choice. You can either accept anything that's in the clearinghouse from a national or multi-res without any condition, or if you have this concern, you can say we'll accept from jurisdictions that have substantive review, which we don't know what that means, and any from non-substantive review countries that are validated. So in other words, they are trying to set up a system whereby the registry can't get out. They just have to choose one or the other in their system. So, but I agree with you. This is problematic.
And I think one of the ways we can address the challenge process, that we can think about criteria that give meaning to whether a mark has been used legitimately or whether it's simply pretextual.
Who would challenge it?
Just for example, a mark owner who owns a mark in a different class of goods and services in a different jurisdiction.
I mean, this has been done in some of the Sunrise systems in the past. So, I mean, I think we flagged this as an issue that I think is still, from the IPC perspective anyway, hasn't come to rest. But there's obviously going to be different views about how to do it. But I really just wanted to raise the question of whether the IPC has been considered on this. And the IPC view was that it should be all nationally or multinationally registered marks, and that the use of challenge procedures and deadlines should be used to mitigate the problem. We recognize this problem, and to mitigate that fashion. So I'm not sure we can resolve that here, but let's just mark that as an issue. So you want to continue on, or is
yeah.
it, you must have.
Yeah. So so the rest of this is fairly mundane, though. The providers contracted with ICANN. Anyway, I think that's good. We've put in here that the clearinghouse should not be a license to operating the clearinghouse should not be a license to use the trademarks for other the trademark database they hook up for other reasons. So one, if they want to do this, they kind of have to make this opportunity available to others to use the database. And two is trademark owners should get to say, I don't want my trademark that's in this database used for any other reason. So it provides for both those things. There's one database, but we might use regional entities to do authentication, and costs are borne by the parties utilizing the service. So what's envisioned is you put your trademark in once, you pay for either the administrative cost of entering the trademark, or if there's a validation that has to occur, that's in the scheme, you pay for that, and then that's a one-time fee, and then registries that use the database would pay to use the database going forward.
What caused confusion for me, this is Jay's got a point, was the fact that I think the IPC and INTA both expressed in their comments to the FBI that we thought that the mandatory provisions that you're mandating were one thing, but if I wanted to be a registry and I want common law rights, I should be able to have that ability to do so. It's just not mandatory on our registry.
Yeah.
And what's unclear to me because of this language about not using it
uh-huh.
is, can that be included in the same database, or is that an ancillary service? And I think that clarification needs to be made.
Got it.
That as long as it's being used to do what the function of the clearinghouse is, the basic function,
yeah.
is a validation and pre-registration mechanism, that if you want to build on top of this, say in Germany, and add book titles as something you'll protect, it can go in that database. And that's a clarification that needs to be made because it's fuzzy on that particular topic.
Can I ask a question? I don't know if you can hear me.
Got it. Other questions, or do you want to move on to your next slide there?
Yeah, I have a question.
Can I ask a question? Can you hear me? Because we don't have anything in London.
If so, must license clearinghouse database competitors. So if they it doesn't offer any ancillary services, they don't have the license to.
Right.
Okay, so.
I think we need to move on to this, but one, Mike Edison does.
One question, thank
you.
No. Kurt, the original clearinghouse had restrictions on who could operate this. There was a prohibition if you were a contracting party with ICANN, you were precluded. In this latest document, I no longer see that disqualification. So ICANN now would intend to allow it to contract contracting party to operate the database.
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know if we. Yeah, I remember the restriction is not there now. I don't remember having a conversation to take it out. I don't know if anybody else did. I don't know if, you know, we want to pick the best entity
yeah.
for the community. So I don't know. I'll find out. What's your opinion?
It seems clear we take something out. Usually a reason why we're
not taking it. Nah, we take out something out for no reason. No, I do you have an opinion about whether that restriction is there or not?
Not within the limited time that Steve has allowed me, so.
I will tell you, as a member of the IRT, the reason that was put in is because we wanted to make sure that it didn't look like it was an inside game. And so we thought if we did that, it would give players that are outside the ICANN circle at this time that have the technical capability and bring in fresh blood to a system that seems to be or has been accused of being played in and regulated by the market players. And that's the reason it would put in. But I would tell you as a trademark owner, your primary concern is getting someone that has technical capabilities to do it and do it right.
Yeah, well, I think it's, you know, if we do this in a transparent way, if there's some red flag that's from, you know, one of the candidates, then can be raised.
Okay, so what are the differences between the trademark as posted and the STI model? One is that we've taken some of the discretion of registries away to use to not use marks from countries with not substantive review, so we've already talked about that. And we've added the, you know, the discretion for a trademark holder to allow or not allow their use for an ancillary service.
URF is a rapid relief mechanism for trademark holders for the most clear-cut cases of infringement intended to be more economical than UDRP. I'll just read it. You know, the expected fee is to be in the range of $300. Results in only suspension, not transfer of the name. The STI, gratefully for all of us, has said it's going to be mandatory in GTLD agreements. So it's re-elevated from best practice and back in play. It contains some examples of bad faith. There's this appeal mechanism in the STI review that in the STI model that is there. So we've just said in the guidebook version, we limit de novo review to a period of 2 years. And, you know, URS will, you know, the complaint will carry the day only if there's no contestable issue of genuine fact. And there's some mechanism for abusers of the system. So what are the two differences between what's published in the GNSO model? Is they have this thing called safe harbors. And, you know, again, I'm out of my depth here with respect to the rest of you guys, but to me, safe harbor is kind of a bright line thing. If you're in the harbor, you're in the harbor. But when you read the what's under the heading safe harbor in the STI recommendation, they look more like defenses to me. If you show this, then that's a defense or a factor for that. So we call it that, you know, defenses rather than safe harbors. And again, we've limited the period of time where a registrant can get a de novo review to, I'm not sure that should be capitalized, maybe italicized, to 2 years. Yeah. So I did go to law school, and that's the only thing I learned.
2 years from the date of
termination. Termination date.
Or the life of the registration, whichever time goes first.
Right. So I hear it's a new name for safe harbors, but the same content. Okay. So I've got to help her.
Go ahead. So, Nick, you'll tell us if there are questions that we need to field.
Yeah, there's a few coming through, but we moved a bit faster, and they're about eligibility under the clearinghouse, which is a slight misunderstanding.
So let me get through the trademark stuff, and then we'll take them. So there's also a post-delegation model that's in the guidebook. So it's, you know, typically if there's names that infringe at the second level, you take that up with the registrant. Right, either in UDRP or URS. This post-delegation is intended to impute the liability onto the registry for cases where there's systemic cyber squatting in a new GTLD, where there's some sort of activity undertaken by the registry. So this would be an independent dispute resolution process. Because it's a rights infringement, we think it's not for ICANN to decide. It's for an independent dispute resolution provider. I've got charts from other presentations that show, you know, there's cases where there's contract violations. That's for ICANN to take up. So ICANN has a contractual compliance role. There's also a role for an independent dispute resolution provider. So there's really remedies, a couple different remedies for rights holders. So remedies under this post-delegation dispute model include sanction, suspension, and termination. And separately, you know, a rights holder can complain to ICANN about a contract breach. So,
now, I will say that I have not drilled down on this particular iteration, but earlier some of the problems I found as someone who worked on the team at the IRT that put together this was the word limitation on the complaint, I think that's a mistake. Secondly, this was not designed by, nor is it intended to be, at least from the IRT perspective, a cheap, effective, fast mechanism. It is designed to be a serious, expensive, in-depth process. And the reason for that was so that registries are not abused by over-aggressive IP owners. And there are those out there that we all deal with in our business that might use this to be harassing. And so I think that you need to rethink cost. I think it needs to be substantially expensive. And I also think word limitations are a mistake, because we're talking about taking away someone's business or fining them a substantial amount of money.
Yep, I agree. So we have given this, there has been a change in that. We have given discretion to the provider to increase the limitation. So you should read that and see if that's that goes far enough. And we've also, even in the case of a default, we've included an examination on the merits. And not just made it a default judgment if the side doesn't answer. So we have made some changes, but I agree with all your sentiments. Not that I, you know.
How is systemic cyber spotting defined under this?
Well, so there's a standard there that requires affirmative conduct. It requires some affirmative conduct by the registry, and a fairly high, you know, a fairly high bar of evidence. So,
so if they're sort of just turning a blind eye, is that affirmative conduct?
Yeah. So I don't know. I think look at VeriSign and look at the amount.
Right. I think the idea is, and I believe that you could show that they have received 10,000 complaints within a year, and they have taken no action to enforce their registration agreement with the registrant to be evidence. But I can tell you right now, having sat at the table, and the CTO and Chris could probably speak to this as well, and Steve, who was in on some of the discussions, the registries and at Yahoo, I can say I fully feel their pain. There are registries out there that know just by the very fact that they are a registry that there are cyber squatted names within their registry. So you do not want the fact that that reality exists because it's a market for this reality to be used to bring you into this process. But if you're a joker.com who was a registrar that for years ignored UDRP decisions, didn't transfer, didn't disclose information, and had, you know, so it got known in the marketplaces, you need to register there because they can never wrestle you away because Joker doesn't participate as a good faith participant within the mechanisms that exist. I think that is evidence of affirmative action of bad faith. But
I think that's a good question.
You know, 10 names that are cyber squatted in your registry is not. And that was Jeff's big concern.
I think Claudia raised a good point, because I think everything you've described, J. Scott, I would say none of that is affirmative conduct. It's all omission. It's all failure to act. I don't transfer names. It may need to be spelled out.
I mean, I can tell you that the UDRP handled that very quickly in the Telstra case, like one of the fifth cases that said failure to act is an affirmative action.
And maybe that's the way.
I assume that you'll find in many bad faith cases in the law in general, ignoring courts have always said, ignoring is an affirmative act. So, but maybe we do need to clarify that in a footnote or something, Kirk, in the final, to say that affirmative conduct can be failure to act.
I think you can put in the where the registry has been put on notice.
Well, they've been put on, again, every registry is on notice
right. That
there's a lot of cyber squatting going on, but so we have to try to draw this line.
Right.
There might be a point at which, you know.
I do feel their pain, because I get people all the time who are writing me nasty letters about UGC stuff that I know, but I don't have a power under terms of service to take care of. So we just need, it's a delicate balance.
That's right.
But we need to make sure that we take that into account.
Right. But it's just a mere failure to act might not be sufficient.
Right.
Right. And then, you know, there's also the
registrant, right? The other, there's all other remedies available, and that's the registrant. So what have we changed? Most of these have been in response to registry questions about this, but we've established a quick look. In order to avoid costs to parties, we've established a quick look, at least to determine that the complainant has standing. The registry will have the opportunity to sort of pay as it goes, not make the full deposit up front, considering an environment where there's several complaints, although if there's several complaints, that would be an indicator right there, right?
Okay.
There's a determination on the merits even in the case of default. And then in the previous version, we had that that the panel would determine the remedy, and the panel recommends the remedy. I can't the decider of that. So that's the change to that. So that's the end of the Nick, if you have some questions, that's the end of the trademark.
Yeah, thank you. The key question, I suppose, comes from Victoria McAvedi, who asks, what rule will be applied to decide between two registered owners of what goes into the clearinghouse? And this is a question which actually just from a member, which shows that there is a lack of understanding of how the clearinghouse works.
Yes, everybody.
So I think this is just a kind of communication issue rather than anything else. This is a complicated subject that there's still, I think, widespread lack of understanding about. And there's one of our members here who maybe hasn't kept up with the correspondence, but is not clear about what goes into the clearinghouse and doesn't. So I don't suppose you can answer that because the clearinghouse doesn't decide.
So go to the very start and say the question again. And I met Victoria at an ICANN meeting,
okay,
where she was with a non-commercial constituent.
What rule will be applied to decide between two registered mark owners?
Say it again.
What rule will be applied to decide between two registered mark owners?
In the clearinghouse.
They both get into the clearinghouse.
That's right, and I think that's a fundamental understanding. Entry into the clearinghouse, there is nothing that keeps you out other than a showing that you actually don't have the rights that you claim you have.
Don't have
so if you're Acme Plumbing and Acme Accounting and you both have a registration for Acme, you go in as long as you can validate that you have rights in that term. If you're Acme in France and Acme in Australia, you both go in as long as you can validate that you have the rights you assert. The only thing that keeps you out of the clearinghouse is failure to meet the criterion that establishes what comes in.
Right.
And the registries decide who gets the domain name because they could choose first past the post, they could choose an auction,
that's right.
They could choose whatever method they want.
That's correct.
That's right. They have to conduct their IP claims or sunrise period.
Okay. Was there any other question?
Excellent.
All right. Very good. Now, if we can move quickly.
Yeah, we've got about 15 minutes.
The other right, overarching
so,
issues.
All right, so this will be just news.
yeah.
So on root scaling, everybody understands the root scaling. I'm going to assume that. Reports are being developed by the RSAC and FSAC. ICANN staff has developed some projected delegation rates to inform that discussion. And we're, and I don't know if this is secret or not, but it shouldn't be because it's ICANN, but there's an RSAC meeting down in Anaheim in a few weeks, so we're going to go down and give a briefing about those projected delegation rates there. And what it, so this is, you're the very first ones to see this, but so that's why I'll send out the slides in a little bit. But the delegation rates are going to be governed by the process. Only so many applications can be competently processed in parallel, and we're thinking it's like 500 applications. So after that, there would be batching of applications. Plus, not all applications get delegated at the same time. Some flunk, some go to extended evaluation, some are objected to. It drags on, right? So what we're saying is that low levels of activity, say if there's 200 applications in the first round, we would see a delegation rate of 100 new TLDs a year. If there's 400, like that's sort of expected, there'd be 215 delegations per year, so not exhaustively high numbers. And then you'll see it kind of gets closer together because it's sort of a self-limiting thing. And if we got infinitely many applications,
It would be limited to, we would see a delegation rate of 917. So if there's an infinite amount of capital available to fund all these applications, you would see 917 delegations per year because the process is sort of self-limiting. But, you know, that's sort of impossible land.
Self-limiting because of your point about how many could actually
right.
be processed.
Right. And that's based on, you know, you want to do things consistently with high quality, be repeatable. So you can't have an infinite span of control and infinitely many evaluators. That's it on risk scale.
Were you saying that some would be delegated before others? I'm just trying to understand.
Yeah. So we get 400 applications. 200 of them pass initial evaluation, and there's no objection. They're clean. So those 200 would go into the route after that. Even that would be spread out based on contract negotiations. But then some are objected to, so that's going to take some time. Some have an extended evaluation. That takes the time. So that stretches out over, you know, 18 or 19 months, really.
Kurt, do you know the timetable? I mean, this consultant's report has now been in about 6 months, and RSAC and SSAC are supposed to review it. Do you know what their timetable is?
Consultants.
You know, the inter-aisle report,
right.
whatever it was. And now RSAC, we're waiting on RSAC and SSAC, right?
Well,
I mean, they're the ones who...
No, I don't know the timetable. The timetable is kind of passed. So they're working on it. I don't know if it will come out before this RSAC meeting in Anaheim, which is in March.
Okay. Thanks.
Economic studies, we could talk about this a long time. We've retained two NTIA-recommended... economists to conduct a three-phase study. The first phase is going to wrap up right after Nairobi, but we're going to get information that allows us to talk about the results of the first phase, which is really what their survey of everything that's been done already and saying, so this is what we're going to do going forward. But so what we're going to do going forward really is to attempt to meet these goals, and they're gonna say by Nairobi and formally right after Nairobi how close they can get to, you know, an empirical analysis to estimate the cost of defensive registrations and develop some sort of metric to assess expected benefits and costs, and then finally, I know there's an interest here, develop a process potentially that on an application-by-application basis seeks to determine whether the detriment outweighs the benefit. And then there's a third phase to the study that might be to develop mechanisms to enhance benefits of new GTLDs, but that's sort of ephemeral based on the outcome of the second study. So that's all I have to say about economic studies, if you want me to pause.
Okay, there are questions about that, Fred?
Which is that presented at Nairobi? I didn't see that on the schedule.
It's not. So
it's a surprise.
So you, I can is accurate. So they're going to issue a report around the 15th of March, and, you know, there's a lot of back and forth about timetable when we're negotiating the agreement. So we're having a set of conference calls with them starting – you know, either this afternoon or tomorrow to get talking points that we can say, okay, here's what the Economist report on March 15th is going to say. But it's really the results of their survey and some direction for going forward. And the real meat of the study, the second phase, is targeted for discussion at Brussels, so to be released before the book.
Kurt, could I ask that once you decide where this is going to be slotted in, that someone who's on the phone from your staff sends an email to me? Because we're doing a section this afternoon on remote participation, and I would want, we don't have this in our presentation, and I would love to push this to our list
so
if anyone wants to participate, can dial in.
So I would say, without certainty, that it would either be described in Rod's president's report or in the detailed thing that follows afterwards that I'm going to...
Okay, if we just get some clarification around that so I could push that out to our list.
Nick had a question from...
We have a question from Mark Bohannon, which says, where is the look at demand and impact on the existing marketplace? Key questions are missing in the study.
Why isn't Mark here?
The shuttles are all canceled.
My flight is still there. So say the question.
Where is the look at demand and impact on the existing marketplace? Shouldn't that be on the table? Demand for new GTLDs and
Well, demand for GTLDs, I think, is going to be ascertained by the EOI, right? But with the real demand question is around demand at the second level, and that's where the questions are. And I think that's in order to determine, you know, the overall expected costs and benefits, you know, that's part of the inquiry to answer the two first questions here. What are the estimated costs of defensive registrations and the overall benefits and costs of the process? I think that
it's hard to answer those. We're not talking about legit. I mean, the first one says demand for defensive registrations, but it's kind of hard to answer number two without making some type of assumption, at least, about legitimate demand. The question is that just going to be an assumption?
I mean, I can tell you, as the owner of 27,000 domain names, of which probably 1,500 have value to me, the demand is a false demand. You know, I really shouldn't have to own Fuck Yahoo. I really shouldn't have to.
I know you should own Dot Yahoo and then build brand awareness, and you won't have to worry about that anymore.
Well,
let's hear some more of
this. Fred. I
mean, I guess you just stated that the EOI demonstrates demand, and I don't think it really does. If I hold a gun, you know, to your abdomen, I think that the demand for bulletproof vests is going to go up substantially. And so I think the EOI basically represents a similar process, at least for brand holders. So it's going to demonstrate actual demand for speculators who actually want to expand the namespace definitively. But I don't think any brand holder actually going to this represents actual demand for it.
To be fair to Kirk, though, Fred, I did hear him say that the real question isn't at the EOI level, it's at the second level, where the questions around demand exist.
Yeah. I'll just say again, I mean, I think it's already been mentioned that these are good questions about the overall expected benefits and a process to assess whether net economic consumer harm might result from individual applications. But we're going to have the EOI before we have this, right? I mean, we will have this report on March 15th, but the economic study overarching issue does not have to be resolved before the EOI happens, right?
So this, the due date for this report is for the Brussels meeting,
okay,
which is pre-EOI launch.
Okay.
EOI will clearly not be launched till, you know, the autumn in the Northern Hemisphere at the earliest.
Okay.
But the communication period starts in Nairobi?
After Nairobi.
It starts the communication period before that.
Well, you start. That's where I believe we get the cart before the horse in this so often in the process. Is what if the Brussels report comes out and says we shouldn't have an EOI, and now you've spent all this time, money, and effort telling everyone that you're going to have an EOI? And I think the false start issue has been very frustrating for the community in general. And so, and as a project management point for ICANN, this has been systematic and problematic for the last 18 months. It seems to me that the point I'm hearing here is you shouldn't have any communications period or anything until such time as you solve the very threshold issues, which your own slide said, which were the overarching issues. Not just start the process, but not even start talking about the process as something that's a fait accompli until you've accomplished the task of resolving the overarching issues.
Okay. Any other questions? Yeah, Sheldon.
While we're on the subject of studies, Kurt, I've heard you say twice now or hinted at the fact that I can't believe that having a new .brand GTLD is going to reduce cyber squatting, hyper squatting, or whatever. of trademarks, which is found in commented by .Yahoo. I wonder, is that assumption, hope, or wish based on any kind of study? What's that based on?
It's based on anecdotal comments of economists or brand holders. So just as there's comments and evidence to the contrary.
Have you thought about trying to incorporate something like that into this study or some other study?
I don't know if it's specifically in the study or not, but it'd be an interesting question to take in there.
And for those on the phone who might not have heard it, Sheldon's point was the statements Kurt's made a couple of times that having a dot brand would be an effective way to deal with cyber squatting problem on brand. Okay.
We need to...
Nick had one.
Another question, another point from Mark Bohannon. In support of Jade Scott, what checks and balances are in place to avoid the EOI not to become a self-fulfilling prophecy? I think I know what you mean.
You think you know what?
He's saying, isn't the EOI going to become a self-fulfilling prophecy? But
you mean that if we start a communications campaign, that makes it more liable to occur?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, I think that goes to Jay Scott's question, it might lend a sense of urgency to resolving some issues, or it might, a negative result is it might lead to a disappointment if we don't resolve those issues, and it's, again, something I can't commit to that doesn't get done. So,
okay. Why don't we
need to wrap up in 5 minutes so we can get to lunch. I'll check to make sure it's here while you all...
No, I want to... Don't get up.
Let's go to mitigating malicious behavior.
I got 5 minutes of your time. Yeah, so...
We got an exodus.
So malicious conduct, I just want to say that there's several improvements in the guidebook. We heard comments from the IPC that we need to be more specific about what we're checking in the background. And so I understand that. If we can bring these HSTLD, high security TLD thing to a close, it would be very good. We got some response from a congressman saying that they're very interested in this program. Centralized zone file access data is the other thing that's going on right now. That's pretty close to closure, we think. So there's some really good work that's been done there. Registry agreement issues. So we've talked about vertical integration. So I want to get on my soapbox about two things. One is the process for amending the registry agreement. There's discussion on this, but it's all with essentially the registry constituency. So here's some issues for us. Should we have all agreements, registry agreements, the same? Should they be individually negotiated as they are now? Is there a benefit to having some process by which all the registry agreements are negotiated? So think about the registrar accreditation agreement. There's a mechanism in that where the GNSO votes by 2/3 to approve changes to the registrar agreement. Very slow process. I'll just say we undertook this big push to amend the registrar accreditation agreement in the wake of this registrar fly issue and an outcry to address the issues raised there. The RAA amendments really don't address that, even though they took 2 years. So I want you guys to get involved in this debate. Think about what you want.
I can tell you right now that no bank, insurance company, or law firm is going to allow an entity to sign a form contract with the kind of commitment you're talking about. They just won't back it. You're going to have some sort of mechanism. Also, because there is a myriad of, you keep talking about the fact that this is all about innovation, but I never see any point for innovation in the system, and if you're going to bring innovation to the system, you can't have a foreign contract because innovation is going to require that there be something. So you can have a base agreement that is then informed by appendices that inform the innovation or something, but you need to get your head around the fact, in my personal opinion, and get the process set up and the staffing level available that you're going to have to individualize these contracts.
Can I just...
So then how do you do that for $25,000 a year?
maybe.
You know, I'm not an economist, and that's one of the biggest struggles we've had with coming up with the right protection mechanisms, is I can't tell you.
Large entities are registrars, right?
Right.
Big companies are registrars, and they, you know, they have a mechanism in the agreement for amending it. So I think there needs to be a mechanism, that's for sure.
Yeah.
It's not a unilateral amendment.
And I think your point about the RAA amendments is one that's worth thinking about. I mean, there are similarities and differences. I mean, but if the RAA amendments didn't work and were too slow, remember how those were done. You got in a room with the registrars, and that was the process. So that didn't work, and it took too long. So maybe we can do better on the registries, as well as doing better the next time the RAA goes through. But I think we do need to see if there are lessons learned there from the RAA process. Okay.
So what's published now is there's a registry proposal for how they should go about it. So I'm just encouraging this group to get involved.
Is it up for public comment?
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's one of those things, you know, 10 years from now, we're all going to be talking about, we adopted the wrong process for this. So where do you guys think we are on RPMs? Are we close? Are we starting over? Are we, because we've been through, we had essentially nothing. Then we got the IRT, and we, significant work was done there. Proposals were made. I can kind of scale the IRT recommendations back. The STI, I think, it reinstated some of the more important ones, which was, a gratifying surprise to me. And so, where do you think we are?
Well, I think where we are is a difficult place because our starting point wasn't entirely satisfactory with the IRT because we started from comment, we were instructed to start from comment that had been submitted. We weren't asked to start from what would be best for the community. So I think a number of people probably have a bit of a problem with that we could have come up with some other things. Where we are is probably something that the whole ICANN process is about compromise. The URF and the clearinghouse are certainly better than nothing. I'm not sure about post-dispute. You'd like it, I'm sure. My having proposed it, other people aren't so impressed. So, but I think with a clean sheet of paper, we could have come up, run the whole process again, we could have come up with much better in half the time.
And I think it's also worth mentioning on behalf of some members of the IPC, and I'm thinking about the IPC comments that were filed, the one acronym that has not been mentioned here today because it is now disappeared from the screen is the GPML. So that seems to be nowhere, which I think most people realize, but on the other hand, if you check within the IPC and the IPC members, there's a lot of support for something like that.
And I think also most we determined, and the reason it was included in the tapestry of solutions, those here from the IRT can disagree with me, is because it was the most requested mechanism of the 375 to 500 comments that Stacey King and her group metrics out for us before we began our process. At this point, I'm going to ask everyone on the phone, we have a separate dial-in that I will post to the list for our luncheon conversation that's going to start it's an afternoon dial-in that we have a separate dial-in, so I think it's probably IPC PM.
That's correct.
So you just need to hang up and redial in at
1:30 Eastern, right?
At 1:30 Eastern, or they can dial in again at 12:40 if you want to hear the WIPO and National Arbitration Foundation, which are going to speak to us during our luncheon on time. But they've got it set up separately. It has something to do with the functionality of the bridge. So if everyone will hang up now and dial in about 20 minutes, we'll be back on. Thank you all.
Thank you, Kurt.
I thank you so very much. We're coffee mom.